I'm a professional. I got a beer, but I asked Barb to help me with that. So.
Wow. Okay, so, but here's the good thing. You remembered to turn on your recorder and put your microphone in front of you before we actually started doing the show.
How many episodes have we done? Oh, jeez.
Yeah, apparently not enough. Okay, well, let's do one more.
Okay, yeah. I got a mic. I hit record. I'm totally pro.
Okay, cool. Well, hey, everybody. Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. This is one of our omnibus bonus episodes that complement our regular weekly episodes. We are going to cover all of the January 1970 issues that were on Marvel Unlimited that we didn't cover in our main episode with the mighty Joe Keating last week. My name is Brian Stratton.
Mine is Rob Milne.
I'm Jamie Wenger.
So as usual, the January 1970 issue of Sergeant Fury is not on Marvel Unlimited, as are about half of the comics that Marvel published in January 1970. And if you have not listened to the episode we did with Joe last week, if you are, you know, someone who maybe you only listened to the Jamie Wenger episodes, and, you know, that's in that case. Hi, Mrs. Wenger. How are you doing?
Hi, Mom.
But no, like Marvel is really very much diversifying their output right now. The superhero fad seems to be dying out. So, you know, only about half their line is superhero books, and they've been trimming a few here and there. And they've got more that are going to go. So,
man, I can't even wrap my head around that concept. It's so alien and foreign to the modern times.
Yeah. I mean, it's they're folding back to what it was when Fantastic Four started almost.
Yeah, you know? In the before times.
Yeah. Everyone in the comics industry thought that superheroes were going to be, like everything else, a cyclical fad. They were going to be like Westerns or war comics. I mean, in fact, like war comics seemed like they were going to endure way longer than superhero books were going to, or teen romance comics, or, you know, like Archie style, you know, teen comedy comics. Like, you know, superheroes traditionally, they'd showed up in the late 30s. They were gone by the late 40s. Some of them came back a little bit in the 50s and then they went away again. So it's like, why wouldn't they just disappear again?
Yeah, I don't understand why that happened, and I don't understand why that stopped happening. Like, I feel like it's like the emergence of a mass culture or something along those lines, but like I haven't been able to put it together yet.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't been able to put anything together. We're going to need someone way smarter than us to be able to solve that question. What we can do, though, is we can read these Marvel comics and we can talk about these Marvel comics.
Damn.
Let's get started on these Marvel comics. Jamie, I have been waiting since 2 weeks ago for you to dive back into the world of Namor the Submariner and tell us about Dorma, Orca, Dorcas, and Krang. My new Fantastic Four.
Man. The most Fantastic Four. Yeah, this is Submariner 24, The Lady and the Tiger Shark, written by Roy Thomas,
art
by John Buscema and Jim Mooney. Yeah, because, you know, as we were discussing last time around, there really weren't enough characters in that comic that we really need to
needs is one more villain.
Yeah we knew it needed something, so it was lacking punch. All right, so anyway, at the end of the last issue, we left the brains Krang, the other brains Dorcas, and the muscle Orca gloating over a chained up Namor. And even chained, he can still beat up pretty much everyone in the room. They do a little bit of fighting, but then he gets like electro zapped from the chains. So then Krang sends already I'm falling apart. Krang sends Orca after Dorma so that Krang can marry her. So meanwhile, Dorma, Lady Dorma, rescues Vashti, who is also in this comic.
And he has a name that is not like every other name.
His name is not confusingly similar to everybody else's.
Yeah, right. Yeah. A whole other vowel
unfortunately.
Set. For those who don't remember, he's like the old Atlantean guy, very wise. He's not like royalty, but he seems to be very close to the crown, right?
He's like a vizier.
Yeah. He got promoted by supporting Namor early on when he was trying to get the throne back. Yeah.
So Dorma rescues Vashti, and because, you know, so now we've got Vashti in this comic. But then, because there aren't enough characters, they encounter Tiger Shark.
Unrelated, so, too. Yeah, he just shows up.
Swimming by.
Yeah, he was like, oh, it's just in a Doctor Strange issue, and I thought I would swing by.
Maybe punch an orca. Yeah.
There's so many great scenes. Sorry to preempt if this is what you're about to talk about. There's so many great scenes in this comic of Tiger Shark just punching killer whales in the face.
Oh man, it's scarring. If you care about the endangered species that is killer whales, you're gonna be real sad to read this issue. If you hate killer whales, though, this is your issue.
You're in for a treat. All right, so Tiger Shark shows up to where Lady Dorma is, and that's when Orca shows up. So Tiger Shark actually beats up Orca, beats up the orcas. And then joins the kind of good guy team on the condition that Lady Dorma, who he calls Miss Seaweed 1969, the condition that she marry him.
So charming.
So him marrying Lady Dorma puts him on the throne? I was
puts
a little confused
closer
about that.
To the throne. Yeah.
Okay,
she's royalty. Yeah.
She is royalty, but she's not like the queen. So.
And Namor is the prince. Is he's the ruling prince, right? Or
his mother was the queen,
but she's not around.
She's dead.
So he is in charge as a prince, but not king.
Except, you know, in those periods, like every third issue where his people rise up and overthrow him. Yeah.
He's doing such a great job.
He's the king, but he's still, everyone calls him the prince. I don't know. It's really weird.
He's the prince and the monarch of Atlantis, but he's not the king of Atlantis.
He just doesn't like that. He's leaving that for, you know, either James Brown or Elvis Presley. Like he's not going to touch that title. Yeah.
Also, I guess it leaves him somewhere to go. You know, he's still a young guy. All right, so then we cut back to the bad guys who have tied Namor to some killer whales and sent them to attack Atlantis. This is worth mentioning because it's so gross. Tiger Shark force kisses Dorma and says that like someday she may even grow to like it. Just
charming,
pretty bad guy stuff.
Yep. I mean, to be fair, we are meant to see him as the bad guy, so it's just I want to say that like that was just put in there so that you wouldn't just because he's going to be fighting
on the good guy's side,
Dorcas and Krang and Orca, like you don't want to confuse him with a good guy.
Right. You know? Yeah. He's not acting with valor.
In this delicate dance that Roy Thomas has set up.
This ballet of evil. A guard tells Tiger Shark that they can't attack the incoming orcas because Namor is tied up on front of it. So then Tiger Shark beats up that guy.
And threatens that guy's family. Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty brutal. It makes them fire on the orcas anyway. So Atlantis fires at the whale chained to Namor or vice versa. And it blows apart the chains and it knocks him out. Crying.
Yeah, because Namor steers the whale. With just like flexing.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Into the laser's path in a way that it explodes the whale to nothing. Speaking
it's like
again.
Maximally badass. Yeah.
Ah, man. I
whale death counter in the corner is just going up and up and up.
This was traumatizing to me, but there were other issues this month that traumatized me more. So, you know, I'm like, okay, whale death is the low bar for trauma
for this
month. Yeah.
The incoming orcas beat up Atlantis. Tiger Shark is there kind of helping. He seems like he's doing okay, but there are a lot of orcas. Namor then wakes. He quickly rescues Dorma. She tells Namor that she married Tiger Shark or has to marry Tiger Shark.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. And he like, I don't know if this is out of character or like character building, but he maturely tells her that like she did the right thing to think of the good of the people. And then goes off to kick some whale butt. So then Namor attacks Krang, but Tiger Shark swoops in to save him. But then Orca misunderstands the whole situation and attacks Tiger Shark. So instead they fight.
Well, he misunderstands because Namor gets tangled in Krang's cape. So Orca thinks that Namor is Krang and comes in to defend Krang and beats up Tiger Shark. So that was a, you know, an actual twist that made some sense, but was understated because of course the thing that makes sense is understated, you know?
Right. Whereas the things that aren't are fully blown six panels. So while they're duking it out, they both in like classic Namor story style get swept down along with some crumbling debris into like a crevasse or a chasm underground and are like presumed dead. With their death, the orcas revert to their normal orca-y status. Atlantis kind of is coming together to bury their dead. Vashti gets better and it ends on like a nice little hug. Yeah, and like to continue the conversation from last week, like why did they do this? Like why did they have so many people in a book that classically has had very little in it? Like maybe they're just over course correcting.
Well, and I think that really sets me up nicely to talk about the next book with the same yes. questions. This one is called Where Stalks the Nightcrawler?
Incredible. Don't get excited. It's yeah. not that Nightcrawler.
It's not that Nightcrawler.
Night hyphen crawler. Right. The hyphen is so important to keep your hopes down. So this is Incredible Hulk number 126, written by Roy Thomas, art by Herb Trimpe. And as often happens, and as we were hinting at, this is both a dense and shallow story at the same time. and a continuation of the crossover event all Roy Thomases have clamored for. So let's get into the story. It starts with, as many Hulk stories begin, with Bruce Banner, no shirt, no shoes, and passed out on his face somewhere. Definitely not passing the minimum requirements to get into a 7-Eleven. After fighting the absorbing man last issue and narrowly escaping death, it turns out that some weird culty people witnessed the fight and are taking advantage of the situation to get puny Banner into some magical ritual. Turns out this isn't just like run-of-the-mill Satanists. This group is working to open a gateway between dimensions and get the undying ones through to our reality.
Mm-hmm. And yes. Where have we heard the undying ones before, Rob?
For everyone who isn't Roy Thomas, this is a story begun in the final issue of Doctor Strange from his first run and was inexplicably carried on recently in Submariner number 22.
Wait, you mean the underwater character who mostly does underwater stuff?
Yep. Yeah. He met Doctor Strange for a second. So the undying ones are bad demon folks that look like winged totem poles and other goofy monsters. They want into our dimension. Doc Strange is now the permanent blockage that keeps them from coming through the pipe. That's where Doc Strange has been hanging out since cancellation. Where does Banner come in? Oh, boy. There's another gatekeeper of a workaround bypass dimension hole to our reality that we are just hearing about, who is an enemy of the Undying Ones. And that creature person is called Nightcrawler. The cult wants Hulk to slay this gatekeeper. And, okay, Nightcrawler. So the Nightcrawler looks like Scorpion, but blue. Mm-hmm. And with a pointed tail, just the face is revealed though, not where Scorpion has everything hidden. And he also has an eye blocking gold hood ornament crown and some gold headphones. And he's got a weird scepter with a dark orb on the end.
And he's huge. He's like maybe 12 feet tall or something.
Yeah. And he seems to stand often like sort of gorilla stance, like hunched down and big, big thing. So Banner's transported into Nightcrawler's domain, but Banner won't cooperate and turn into the Hulk. He is once again trying to choose Hulk abstinence. he is set.
Which always works. Yeah, abstinence always works.
That's the other new trope in the Hulk, is he's just trying not to Hulk out all the time. Yep. And it's always, he's like, I'm never becoming the Hulk again. Page 3, he's the Hulk again. You know, he's also like the Hulk on the cover. So he's set on letting Nightcrawler kill him. This is kind of the Banner death wish is starting to happen a lot more often too. But the cult sends a naysaying lady named Barbara through the portal as a bonus sacrifice. So she's starting to be like, hey, maybe we shouldn't sacrifice people to let demons into our dimension. And they're like, you don't belong in this cult anymore through the portal.
She's also wearing like a t-shirt with some bats on it. She
really didn't try to dress up for the cult that day. Yeah.
Rob, did you get your wife's take on this issue? And what did she have to say?
I haven't brought up the naysaying Barbara yet, but I do plan to later this evening. And she's, you know, ends up being quite pivotal to this story.
True. Yep.
As convoluted as it is. So Nightcrawler immediately begins the killing process on her when she shows up in the dimension. And this stresses Banner out enough to, you know, not Hulk abstinence. So now the punching. Hulk is doing pretty well, but Nighty uses his scepter of shadow to bring total darkness in the domain. And there's a lot of fine, like, negative art with all the panels rendered as light blue and white over a black background. So it's like sketched in negative.
I really liked this. I know there are folks who are not crazy huge fans of Herb Trimpe or his art. I'm not one of them. I actually am digging the Herb Trimpe Hulk so far. But one of the things I really like about what he does is it's like what he lacks in just sort of like that. I don't know. He's not the most sophisticated comics artist, but he does find interesting things to try. Mm-hmm. And I think the worst thing you can be as a comics artist is generic and boring. And I feel like Trimpe, whether he's successful or not, is not often generic or boring.
Yeah. He's trying stuff. So getting back to the black background. So now we're in the negative version. Finally, Hulk latches on to a floating rock and punches it.
Was the flaw in the plan. He left him a rock to punch.
He punches it so hard it explodes in light. Science. So the lady Barbara breaks the scepter to stop any new shadow shenanigans. But Nighty uses his hood ornament crown to send out sonic beams that hurt the Hulk. So how does Hulk deal with this? He claps so hard, he reverses it and blows up everything and the entire Nightcrawler domain. Again, science. So Nightcrawler, Hulk, and Barbara pop up into the Undying One's dimension. Suddenly, because that's what happens when your dimension goes out, I guess. Mm-hmm. And Nightcrawler immediately shifts to attacking the ghastly hordes of the Undying Ones. Strange is here. He's there and clogging the pipe between the Undying Ones world and ours. And he's stoked because this skirmish will distract everyone long enough for the stars to come out of alignment. So there will be no doorway to Earth. Problem solved. And then Barbara volunteers to be the dimension clogger and set Strange free. So she takes the sacrifice. She's like, I was going to sacrifice this Banner guy. I feel bad. You know, give me this job. So Strange takes Banner to the old sanctum and gets them both some normal people clothes. Then Strange vows that since the Undying Ones are held off for a long while, he doesn't need to do any sorcering and will go be a medical consultant. It's really what he says.
He says, perhaps the world is ready for plain, ordinary Stephen Strange again. Not Stephen Sanders.
Yeah.
Oh,
I noticed that's just gone. Yeah.
That's a dig on eternity. Eternity must be pissed.
Yeah. It's like, I changed your mail, man.
that's a federal crime.
Banner is really bummed that he can't just walk away from being the Hulk so easy, of course, and that's where we leave things.
I have to make an apology to one of our social media fans. We had a listener comment on one of our Instagram posts after the Doctor Strange Submariner crossover. This was Childhood Comics Library on Instagram said, don't you think Rascally Roy was trying to set up Defenders with that Doc Strange wrap up? And I said, well, it's possible, but Roy would have been playing an awfully long game if that were the case, as we're still a couple years away from the Defenders at this point. But like after reading this issue, I don't know if he's actually got like the Defenders exactly in mind, but he's definitely trying to like keep something going with these characters who are, you know, either kind of a little directionless or
the Misfits team. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or who are like losing their book. We haven't seen a ton of Marvel crossover stuff. I think this is something that Joe Keating pointed out. Like right now at this, in this era of Marvel, like, especially in the books that Kirby's doing, he's not crossing the characters over with other Marvel, like anything that Lee and Kirby are doing, they're not crossing anyone over. And I feel like Roy knows that that is one of the greatest strengths of Marvel Comics is the shared universe thing. And so I feel like he is working overtime trying to keep this going. And I wouldn't be shocked to learn that like in the back of his mind, he had this Defenders idea, maybe not fully baked, but ready to go.
Mm-hmm. So you were wrong.
Yeah, so I don't always apologize for everything that I get wrong, because if I did, that would be the podcast. but I was totally wrong on that one, I think. Very sorry. Sorry for pretending I knew what I was talking about.
I'm sorry I can't apologize.
Now I'm going to make some more stuff up about Daredevil number 62. This story is called Quoth the Nighthawk Nevermore. It's written by Roy Thomas. The art is by Gene Colan with Sid Shores doing the inks. This is really interesting. Like I mentioned, we're going to talk about a story involving Nighthawk, which is a character that we've never seen before. And then Jamie started to mention, it's like, oh no, we've seen this guy. And then he panicked and he just left the show. So I don't know what's going on. But I'm just going to get through this. And then when he comes back, he comes back. Maybe he had an emergency or something.
Maybe Nighthawk took him out.
Maybe Nighthawk took him out. Our story begins with Daredevil staking out a movie theater on an anonymous tip. And that means we get to see some absolutely gorgeous Gene Colan New York cityscapes. So Colan did three books this month. He did a romance book, and then he did Captain America and Daredevil. I think it's obvious which one he had both the time and desire to be spending, because this is such a good looking book.
You can tell the make and model of any car that's in a scene, you know.
Yes. So sure enough, two lowlifes arrive to stick up the box office, but Daredevil springs into action. And just as he's about to apprehend them, a strange new costumed adventurer named Nighthawk shows up and steals his glory. Nighthawk beats up the hoods as Daredevil is struggling to recover from a sudden and unexplained dizzy spell. Daredevil thanks Nighthawk for the assist, and Nighthawk says that he'll turn the crooks into the cops. But as soon as the man without fear leaves, Nighthawk just lets him go. What the heck?
He just likes the thrill of the catch and release.
Apparently, yeah. So after letting these crooks go, Nighthawk drives home to the stately manor of Kyle Richmond, boy tycoon. He exposits to us that he was the one who tipped Daredevil off about that robbery. And also he tells us that he was the one who injected Daredevil with a drug that made him dizzy during the fight. We then get Nighthawk's backstory, which is that he mixed up an alchemical potion that enhances his physical prowess while the moon is shining. He makes reference to this being the work of the Stranger, and fighting Captain America to a standstill in Avengers number 70, which is strange because that book does not exist.
Right.
Like we've proven this. I've looked for it everywhere online. There are references to it in other comics, but this book does not exist anywhere. So, the next day, the Daily Bugle is predicting the end of Daredevil's career. And that Nighthawk is going to replace him, which Karen Page thinks is a terrific idea.
I love how catty she is every time. She's alluding to his secret identity nonstop.
Yep.
But just enough to dig at him where no one would know. And
yeah.
That's a nice little play, at least with the dumb relationship thing that happens in these comics. This is nice.
I mean, she really is coming off as like a jealous lover, like, mm-hmm. and Daredevil is the other woman, you know, like, and she's like, I'm going to give your secret away. I'm going to blow up your other relationship so that we can be together. Because what you're doing there is not cool and it's not healthy.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to stand for it. So, yeah, it's great. He just can't quit Daredevil. So he goes daredeviling around the city. And then he gets a brainstorm to make a bunch of payphone calls. Kids used to have to go into a little metal box and put coins into a physical phone to be able to contact people.
A phone that anyone could touch at any time, just sitting there. Yeah.
And did with all sorts of parts. Yeah. We don't know who he's calling, because this is the one part in the story, where he doesn't just tell us out loud what he's doing. He then sees Nighthawk, who's beating up some more crooks, and Daredevil accidentally, bumps into him while helping to take them down. After the fight, Daredevil apologizes, says maybe it is time for him to hang up the tights, and, you know, Nighthawk is not trying to talk him out of it. So a few nights later, Nighthawk catches a jewel thief who claims to be a friend of the crooks from the start of the issue. He figures that Nighthawk's going to let him go, too. And Nighthawk's all, sure, why not? You know, the sheep who think I'm the best won't care either way. What's one more crook? But the jewel thief turns out to be Daredevil, and the jewel turns out to be a microphone, and the sheep below are listening to everything that he is saying about them. So now the cat's out of the bag, the hawk's out of the night. And
wait. So just one more time. Imagine, if you will, the master of disguise that is Bruce Wayne, matches Malone or something. I think that's a Bruce Wayne.
So he's got a mustache and sunglasses.
Yeah. What he does is much like what Sherlock Holmes would do, which is to disguise his face with makeup and other accoutrements. But what Daredevil does is one step beyond, of course, because as we know, Daredevil loves the, what are those called? Babushka dolls, mamushka something. I'm really screwing that up. He loves the nesting dolls of costumes. So he has a mask of a human face over his Daredevil costume, somehow keeping the horns down, or they're in the hair. I don't know. But again, just seeing him pull a mask off, a human faced mask off of his Daredevil mask. Again, that I laughed so much and so hard at that concept.
It's incredible. It gets me every single time. That's what like everyone does in the Marvel universe. They never take off their own costume first. They just slap another one on on top of it. And it's always realistic enough to convince whoever they're trying to lie to that they are a totally normal human person
with a dead face.
Yeah. With a latex face that doesn't move or react in any realistic way.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. That was an aside, but it needed to be done.
It did. How did Daredevil figure all this out? Well, you remember when he went into the gross phone booth? I'm being redundant. Remember when he went into the phone booth? Well, what he did was he called all the local police precinct captains, and he discovered that Nighthawk never turned in the crooks who tried to rob the movie theater. So did a little legwork, did a little discovery. That's how he knew Nighthawk was a bad guy, and that's why he went after him. But the mood is still out, so Nighthawk is still a force to be reckoned with. He ducks into a subway, and Daredevil knocks him in front of a train. Nighthawk slips around it. He gets away, and he taunts DD, saying that one of these moonlit nights, victory will be Nighthawk's. So there you go. Very first appearance in Marvel Comics of Nighthawk. Oh, hey, Jamie's back.
Hey, hey. Jamie.
Hey,
hey, where did you go?
Did I miss any devils?
No, I mean, I just talked through Daredevil. I just figured we'd keep things rolling. Everything okay on your end?
I assume so. I mean, it's possible something horrible happened somewhere, but I'm not aware specifically of what that something might be.
Okay.
Like all your right, attitude. Well, it's already so sunny.
Since you're back, do you want to walk us through Iron Man number 24, which came out this month?
Sure. My Son, the Minotaur, written by Archie Goodwin, art by Johnny Craig and George Tuska. So we open on the recent past with a view of an unconscious woman who's washed up on the shore of an island with the shadow of a horned figure kind of coming upon her. You just see sort of the shadow. We know from the narration and the cover that this is Madame Mask / Whitney Frost. Even though from this image, you can't see the one defining feature that she has, the mask, because her leg is raised and like you're seeing her kind of like butt, butt forward. But it's just black. It's not, it's just shading. So then we get this like semi-abstract dreamscape flashback of recent events and the love triangle between Tony, Madame Mask, and Sitwell, until she's awakened from this dream state by the Minotaur, who like immediately knocks her right back out again. An off-panel torch holder tells someone named Miklos not to kill her and to check out that mask that she has. We then jump to the present, where a mask is being retrieved from like a shady mask stealer guy, before it's being investigated by S.H.I.E.L.D.'s Agent Sitwell for any clues. So then we cut to see Tony partying with a pile of winnings in a casino and with a bunch of ladies like all around him at a roulette wheel. And he's just talking about how he's not in the mood for a party, which
like, shouldn't have put on that white tux and headed to the casino. Yeah, then, bud. Yeah.
It looks like the most fun you could possibly have. And he's like, oh, man.
I do kind of like the idea that maybe Tony Stark just doesn't know how to handle grief in any other way. Like, right. He's only known this life.
Yeah.
It's like, I need to drink and play roulette yeah. in a real fancy suit. That's the only way through this. Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds like that.
Step one, suit. Step two, drink. Yeah.
He doesn't have the emotional tools available to him to deal with something like this.
Yeah.
So he goes up to the hotel room despondently, and he is ambushed by Madame Mask's mask. But it turns out that it's Sitwell, and he's confronting Tony.
That's such a good scene.
Yeah, it was very cool. Yeah, so he's confronting him about like if that she's still alive and that Tony's been lying about it and that there's all this jealousy between them.
Oh yeah, Tony's fingerprints are on the mask as well as hers.
Yeah,
Tony's fingerprints are on Madame Mask.
Yeah, you'd say are real skeevy.
Yeah, which is the bigger issue here is that when she and Tony were abandoned on an island somewhere, they had a moment of romance that A, Sitwell didn't know about that, and then Tony never told him that Whitney Frost was alive either. So not right. a good friend.
And he like claims was to spare him the upset, was to spare Sitwell, you know, having to be brokenhearted or whatever.
Right. And then he says they had a moment of romance. It seems like, yeah. I guess they had a moment, but.
Yeah. He's very careful not to get quantitative.
Yeah. It's very Clinton-esque.
Yes.
Yeah. Because they had that one moment, but then I think they have also had other moments, right?
I think there were some inferred moments, but maybe not, because he was a captive of Midas and there was all that jazz and then they left.
It was one extended moment.
Yeah. Just a smooch.
May still be going on.
Yeah. Not- right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then we cut back to the island with Whitney Frost, who's now wrapped not in her typical mask, but in these like facial bandages.
Invisible man.
Mask. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So she's invisible manned up, discussing the emotional trauma of that nightmare thing that grabbed her. And she's having this conversation with a Dr. Rylak, who says it was just a delusion. I will henceforth be referring to this man as Dr. Anagram, because I think you should keep
trying to say the name.
You'll just get crazier each time.
I think it's pronounced Dorcas.
Dr. Dorcas Vryolak Vashti.
So I wanted to point out that everything we've talked about so far in this issue, this has been 5 pages.
Yeah.
And this is the either 7th or 8th scene, depending on how you count it, in these 5 mm-hmm. pages. So they are jamming story in here.
We're getting 9 panel pages, too, which we don't see a lot of.
Right. Johnny Craig is doing the art.
Yeah.
And how.
Yeah.
So this doctor that she's talking to is apparently a master plastic surgeon who's been perfecting a revolutionary plastic surgeon technique here in isolation on this island, which is pretty convenient.
Mm-hmm.
He leaves her. He kind of gaslights her about what she saw a little bit, but then he leaves her and heads sort of downstairs into this underground Egyptian looking cave, where his son, the Minotaur, or a Minotaur, is impatiently waiting. And he's like complaining about having failed, like there have been too many failures or something like that. The doc tells him that this time it's really going to work. It's going to be fine. He just needs more chemicals. And you know that what that means, he says to the kid. I didn't know what that meant, but apparently it means like robbing bars and getting really angry about people hating him for hating them for hating him.
Mm-hmm. He's a bull, man.
Yeah, yeah. He's really resentful for having a bull for a head, which I actually don't think I've mentioned. He has a bull for a head.
And he has hooves, I think, too. Otherwise, his upper body is pretty normal guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The backstory on why he has a bull for a head is that his dad discovered some ancient hieroglyphic formula for making some kind of super race. But his son was dying from a disease, and like as a last ditch effort, he used it on him, which made him crazy strong, but then like slowly turned him into like the classic bullhead that you're picturing.
That's why FDA approval is so critical.
Oh yeah.
For experimental drugs.
All right. So then both Sitwell and Iron Man respectively have started searches for Whitney. And we learned that Dr. Anagram wants to make Whitney a bullhead too, so that she can marry the son and they can have bullheaded children.
Bride of Frankenstein Minotaur. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Frankentor. we'll work on it.
Get the people working on that.
Yeah.
Actually, I mean, honestly, don't bother. I mean, you'll find out why.
Yeah, it's fun. So thankfully we get a break from all this plotting so that Iron Man and Bullhead can have a big fight. It ends with the Bullhead being knocked out and Iron Man putting out some like non-metaphorical fires, so like actually fires. So then the still facially bandaged Whitney discovers the doctor's evil plan for her and then like real quick gets him in an arm lock. Like, and that's great. She's badass and she should be badass. And that was a good bit of story. Mm-hmm. Then we get this really cool page. It has almost no words. It's colored with only red, yellow, and green. Mm-hmm. And they're not really like multi-shaded. It's pretty like uniform colors.
And really poppy and EC Comics. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. All right. So here's what happened. Bullhead jumps out to get Whitney. Sitwell jumps out from nowhere to shoot Bullhead. Dr. Anagram attacks Sitwell with the candlestick from Clue, and then the evil duo make off with Whitney into like an underground cave. And it's just like bam, 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 bam. Yeah. It's really, really rapid. Very cool. Iron Man kind of gadgets himself onto the scene and fights with Bullhead some more. They slam each other into the cave walls really hard while Whitney's strapped to a table, kind of like James Bond style. Just as the doctor is about to inject Whitney with the Bullhead serum, Sitwell appears and like sharpshoots the syringe out of his hand, which is like the best thing Sitwell, I think, has ever done.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the walls of the cave have been weakened by all this fighting. So Iron Man is there holding up the walls, which reminded me of like 9 different things. It's definitely like the Hulk in Secret Wars kind of holding up the mountain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think there's some other stuff too. I just haven't been able to place it.
I mean, it's very like, you know, like Samson and the temple, if you want to get back to like super biblical stuff, but like,
oh, I do.
Yeah. And then the cover of the Hulk annual that Steranko did where he's like, which is what the Secret Wars thing is referencing, where
Whoa.
It's like, he's just like putting the logo on his back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, yeah, but I mean, and we've seen like Namor getting buried by a ton of stuff. Everyone's getting buried by things in comics these days.
Yeah, I guess because you can't shoot and show blood and stuff like that. So it's like an easy situation to put them in. It's probably fun to draw.
Yeah. Oh, and of course, the classic Ditko big heavy thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there you go.
Which shows up again in this month's Spider-Man. So all the kids getting crushed by things.
Everyone loves it. So the doctor orders the Minotaur to grab the woman. Sitwell vows to fight for the woman he loves, but instead of listening to his dad, the doctor, the Minotaur just walks on by him and insists that they all must go free and that only Iron Man is capable of getting them all out to safety.
And Bullhead's gonna hold up the mountain instead.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, he shoves Iron Man out of the way and takes over holding up the cave. Like, very heroic. Then we get I can't tell if this works well or is old. Like I don't have a read on it. But he gives like a tragic monologue about how love and hope and that's all great. And he and the doctor don't have any of that. And then gets crushed to death by the cave-in.
Yeah. I don't know that it would have worked for me, but there's one thing that Johnny Craig does is it's like a really subtle thing, but he has a tear coming down from his eye as he's talking about this. And there's something about like, seeing the monster cry.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, like that works.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that, yeah. I mean, it infuses it with like just that extra little bit of emotion that kind of, you know, he's been turned into a monster, and then his father has made him a monster.
Right. Being the monster didn't make him the monster. His dad made him the monster.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, it's as much like taking not revenge, but like he's punishing his father and himself for what they have done.
Yeah. And the other version of this monologue is like the one at the end of the last Thor one with the circus crime folk, but not the circus right. of crime. I don't know. I can't remember.
Yep.
You know, and like that's like the cheap version sort of, and this is like the emotional better version, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which we keep getting like such a higher level writing from Archie Goodwin, I think, with mm-hmm. where you care about this monster. Like, yeah, it looks pretty dumb in a lot of the story, but suddenly you're like, no, this is a mm-hmm. noble sacrifice. This yeah. villain has, you know, done the turn very quickly at the end. Mm-hmm. And so,
yeah, that the pacing of it, I think, is probably a problem that is like widespread at this point, or at least it reads like a problem now, where it's like, mm-hmm. oh, he's good and he's dead. You know, like
right,
three panels or less every single time. And like nowadays, yep. that would be a more protracted experience.
yeah.
Be yeah, like, hi, I'm Magneto. I'm evil. And then in the end of the book, he's like, yeah, I'm going to run the X-Men. Yeah.
Right. 20 years later. All right. So yeah. So they're crushed to death. Iron Man, Whitney, and the unconscious Sitwell come up from being underwater. They escape the Egyptian caves. Iron Man gives Whitney the mask that Sitwell like very sweetly had on him the whole time, kind of in his jacket pocket. She says she puts on the mask that Tony was the one who gave her confidence and Jasper was the one who gave her hope. And she goes off to prove to all of them that she's worthy of that faith in her, which was a very strong ending. And then they like tack on one more panel of Tony, like getting the last word in as he like mentally describes her as like, she's the toughest judge of herself of all, or something like that.
It's like, yeah, we know, Tony.
Yeah, she just said the thing. You didn't have to say the thing. It was fine.
Shut up, Tony.
Let me just hang a lantern on that.
Yeah, right. Alpha male, we get it. Yeah, you're great.
Yeah, so I am a huge EC Comics fan, and I've loved EC Comics as a kid. I bought all the reprints of them whenever they came out, and I like. Johnny Craig is one of my very favorite EC artists and favorite comics artists of all time. And like this story reminded me so much of like the Night Phantom story mm-hmm. from Iron Man 14, which we talked about with Chelsea Kane. But it has this like really classic EC style to it, like with the 9-panel grids and, you know, and a lot of story. Like, I mean, EC stories were like 8 pages long and they crammed a ton of story into them. But like you talked about it, Jamie, page 15 of this issue is incredible. That's the mostly wordless one mm-hmm. with the bold color splashes. And those 3x3 panel grids, that's what Dave Gibbons was referencing in Watchmen. That's why Watchmen looks like it does. Mm. And Johnny Craig is one of the artists he's paying tribute to.
Cool. That's very cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's like anytime Johnny Craig gets the reins, it only seems to happen like once a year, but I'm so happy to see it.
Yeah, this is a great comic book. I was poking fun at the amount of story in it, but like it's like paced better than average, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the story's clear. I mean, a ton of stuff happens, but you're never lost or confused by it. Yeah.
There are great perspectives in the art too along the way. Like you get some cool like eyeball shots, like especially with her mask, like kind of mm-hmm. seeing her eye through all that.
And Johnny Craig draws beautiful ladies too. Like,
yeah.
So like that's in there.
I think this is all, you know, again, indicative of the turn to this is a horror tale. This is mm-hmm. Bride of Frankenstein. Yep. This is with the Minotaur. Like,
yep.
So again, like the Night Phantom setup of that story, it's just perfect for Johnny Craig to be on.
Yeah. And the horror isn't tacked on. It's not like a story skin like we've seen someplace else. Like this mm-hmm. does need to be an Iron Man story for mm-hmm. a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's like intertwined with the monster stuff in a way that's better than a lot of what we've seen so far.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then in the letters page, there's a letter from Jim Novak in there, who would go on to become a production manager and staff letterer at Marvel Comics for years and years. He actually designed the version of the Star Wars logo that is still in use to this day.
Whoa.
Yeah. He designed it for the comic, which came out before the movie did. And then the movie very quickly adopted that version, switched to that version.
That is very cool.
Yeah. Yep. So there you go. Jim Novak, pretty cool dude. Talking of super cool dudes, how about that Black Panther?
Yeah.
Let me tell you about
that's
that.
That's a good transition.
Jeez. That was really related. Let's talk about Avengers number 74, Pursue the Panther.
Okay, if we have to.
We do. Oh, this is going to be rough. Written by Roy Thomas, art by John Buscema, and Tom Palmer doing the finishes. So this picks back up from last issue. We've got the Sons of the Serpent ready to stoke a race war. This issue starts with the Avengers watching a TV news story about Black Panther going on a crime spree. And Panther is targeting businesses owned by known supporters of Sons of the Serpent. This makes people speculate that Black Panther is, well, black.
slow down.
And militant at that. So Barton notes, or Goliath 2, or Giant Hawkeye, whatever you want to call him.
giant guy.
Notes that T'Challa didn't make it known because he, quote, wanted to be judged as a man, not a racial type.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So here we go.
So first of all, let's leave aside the awkwardness of that whole thing for a second. But like, so Black Panther, I mean, I believe he's widely known to be African, and he has been running around up until recently. Like, he was wearing the half mask for a while, which clearly shows his skin tone. And he was running around in public with like the world's most famous super team. And so like this whole attempt by Roy Thomas to like stuff that back in the bottle, and it's like, no one knows he's black. It's like, I mean, I'm pretty sure we do. I'm pretty sure, yeah. Like, you know, I'm absolutely certain that if like even a glimpse of him, you know, his skin tone being revealed happened in 1968 or 69, like that would have been front page news. Like, you know, you would have, if anyone saw it, everyone would know about it.
Yes.
You know, so there's no way that people don't know that Black Panther's black.
Well, okay. If you don't like shaky premises, then you're not going to like the rest of this.
Well, as long as it doesn't have any awkward racial relation conversation.
Then we'll be fine. Yeah. Okay, great. Well, let's just be silent for a while. No. Okay. So the news then runs a clip they just got in of the Supreme Serpent announcing that they will unmask the Panther live on TV in a few hours later that night, directly after showing another clip of the Panther in action that they said they just received. So that should be confusing and a note to anyone following the, let's call it a plot of this story. the Panther, the real Panther, gets to watch all this while being chained up in the sea snake headquarters of the Serpents, which is in the harbor, which is a giant snake submarine that,
yeah,
of course.
What else are they going to get around in?
So then Panther gets to watch another fresh episode of One America News. I mean, Fox. I mean, wait, it's Dan Dunn's hate mongering show. Dan has Montague Hale and Monica Lynn back on.
The third time, right? Because it was two in the
I think
the
last they were on issue. Two last time. Yeah.
Yeah, so they're doing a special this week. That's it's sweeps week.
I think he fired his booker. Yeah. He's just like, bring him back.
And of course, Monica had changed her tune about just being a celebrity and not being part of, you know, not participating in what she called the black cause, because she had been rescued by the Panther after the Serpents tried to take her. And talking with Hale. Montague Hale, who is this other guest. So she's ready to embrace this cause. And Dan and Montague exchange a lot of rhetoric that is including that the Panther being black and guilty is representative of the whole black movement being riddled with traitors. So good times.
Yeah.
And then as T'Challa is musing to himself about the argument representing the nation as a tinderbox, the Supreme Serpent talks to him through a speaker and reveals that he will be the spark to start the race war. So this seems like a little bit of drama amidst weird plot threads. Now,
also, Panther is like chained, very prominently chained throughout this whole thing. Like,
like disturbingly reminded me of watching Roots as a kid.
No, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's very intentional. He's got like the collar around his neck. He's got the shackles around his wrists and ankles, like steel chains to the wall. I mean, the imagery is, it's you can't
evocative.
Miss it. Yeah. You can't miss it. It is what it is. Yep.
So, what's up with these Avengers? They're back. You know, we started with them watching TV, so let's get back to them. we jump back to the Avengers. This is just Vision, Goliath, two, Giant Barton, Yellow Jacket, and Wasp heading out to capture T'Challa or the impersonator of T'Challa. Each of the boys ends up getting insulted from the masses in some way. This is a nice little segment.
I thought that was pretty interesting that like they each get their moment and they're not great moments.
No. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Vision is called a grim android with a voice that gives you the creeps, and they're worried because he's neither white or black. So they don't know whose side he's on. And he just sort of phases through the sidewalk to walk in the sewers and not be around people.
Which is a cool, like he would rather be in sewage than engage with that, with a race war conversation.
Yeah. And so then Yellow Jacket gets mobbed by a bunch of kids coming out of a movie. They want his autograph. But then you find out that two of his autographs are worth one Captain America autograph.
Still seems generous.
Yeah, seriously.
Before signing anything, he just shrinks to escape them. So he just disappears. And then Clint, I think rightfully so, has some teenage ladies make fun of his costume. so he gets big and messes up traffic.
Maybe my favorite scene in the entire story.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Yeah, because he's like, oh, it wouldn't be cool if I was to eavesdrop on him, but I'm gonna. And
then I think they're like, into my muscles. He's thinking all this kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just dumb stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a weird, like, why do this? Especially in this particular issue, which is already like a very special episode kind of thing.
Yeah. I think it's because it's meant to show that, like, because of Panther's association with the Avengers, that, like, everyone's turning on
undermine their credibility. Yeah.
All the white people are turning on the Avengers now. But although, I mean, Hawkeye's costume's dumb no matter what. So
that has nothing to do on that one.
There's no racial angle to that whatsoever. No.
I think there are very specific circumstances where that costume would be super cool and it's not being a giant superhero.
right.
And it's more about like, it definitely a dance club fun boy kind of thing.
I was going to say, yeah. I mean, if it probably is a costume that looks a lot better with a bunch of dollars poking out of the briefs.
Yeah. Yeah. So Wasp actually finds the fake Panther and does what they're trying to do. And he's stealing some jewels. He confirms he's a fake to her by his diction and his lack of speed. So she's just like, Panther would have caught me. I had time to shrink, and you don't sound like the Panther.
Mm-hmm. This is her best moment in like at least 10 issues.
This might be her best moment ever. So far.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she doesn't, you know, catch him exactly, but she, you know, finds him and
mm-hmm. he finds him and she identifies him you know, as a fake.
And then we get Goliath. Oh, Clint, man, he's climbing up the outside of the same building like King Kong. And and then he breaks his arm in through a window. So just punches through a window trying mm-hmm. to grab the fake Panther.
Some of the coolest drawn scenes in the book by Big John Buscema here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the eye, right? The eye, mm-hmm. the shot of the eye with Hank being small.
Yeah. Like giant Goliath and shrunk down Yellow Jacket.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All like nonsensical, but nice looking.
Terrific.
Then Vision rolls in and they are about to get the faux Panther on the roof of this building when a serpent airship shows up and hits Clint with gas grenades and he falls. He hangs for a minute. He's, you know, of course, giant, and falls many stories into the street. He's too gas grenaded to be able to shrink. So there you go. He just crushes some cars and stuff. But Vision saves him by flying down, and then Vision increases his mass and slows him down.
Sure.
Science.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. It was just a better solution to that problem right there, right?
Yeah. There's a better solution in the Silver Surfer coming up later, but it's still dumb. So Fake Panther gets away and the gang heads back to the mansion, where Monica Lynn shows up and gets treated kind of crappy. Then they all tune in for the Supreme Serpent to say this: "We shall unmask before your very eyes this criminal, this anarchist in superheroes' clothing. And when we do, America will know at last its real enemies and what must be done about them." The Avengers know this will cause a coast-to-coast bloodbath and race war. They comment that they need him to keep talking for a few more minutes at this point. He does just that, apparently, and that was enough time for them to leave the mansion, get in an elevator in an abandoned studio. I have no idea what happened here chronologically, but it is magic. They're watching TV in the mansion, then they're in an elevator opening in an abandoned studio where there are serpents. So they burst into the studio, which has a studio audience too, where the serpent is ranting, and they unmask the Fake Panther. Before the Avengers can do anything, the Fake Panther is unmasked, who says, "No black American can rest while a white American lives."
And he appears to be a black person.
Yeah.
The fake Panther. Yeah.
But we don't really know this is the Fake Panther until the next page, where we know it's the Fake Panther because Vision is sneaking into a cell where the Bound Panther sits behind another Supreme Serpent who is watching this all on TV. And we assume then Panther tackles one Supreme Snake Man through a wall where it turns out he is on the studio set, not in the snake submarine still. Don't know. The real Panther pulls a second mask off the previously unmasked Fake Panther.
Hey, pull the Daredevil.
It's the double yep. Scooby-Doo. Yeah. And reveals a white-skinned goon who is wearing a T'Challa mask and formerly a Panther mask over that. Because double up those masks.
Yeah, you're not supposed to put antiperspirant on your face most of the time, but in these specific situations, they say it's okay.
You better, yeah. So fighting ensues, and both of the Supreme Serpents are unmasked to reveal Dunn and Hale. This is what Douglas was talking about. A couple episodes ago. So, he noted this is the second time a person of color was revealed to be leading the Serpents. And we do also have thrown in a normal white bigot for fun. Mm-hmm. So don't want to leave Dunn out. So this whole issue was not only a bunch of bigoted and triggering words if you lived through the previous 5 or 6 years, but Dunn
and 50 years before that.
Yeah. Or
the 200 years before that.
Right. For us, we had just a brief break, I guess, in our lives. Yeah. But yeah. but Dunn and Hale reveal that they never cared about the outcome or any cause except power for themselves, which, well, again, is a triggering reminder of the previous administration and word for word rhetoric of the current right wing hate machine.
Yep.
So Roy had to throw the twist of having Hale be a fraud too. I don't know. Then we get to T'Challa trying to untangle this a bit by saying to Monica Lynn, "Don't underrate people, Monica. Most of them know that cause may be right, though a leader or two be wrong."
Which is a weird thing to say once you have just revealed the leaders of a racist movement, like as not being dedicated to that movement. It's like, so wait, is the Black Panther saying that being a hateful white person or a militant black person is good? Like,
They're really true to it,
it's like, as long as you're genuinely a racist,
right?
Like, you know, I mean, that's because that's how it reads, you know.
Yeah,
like,
it's so bad. This twist, having those two, just ruins everything.
Yeah, and you know, like, I don't want to get into like a woke off about this, right? Mm-hmm, so, right. Like, I want to look at it in the context of the time that it was published, and I want to also proceed with the assumption that Roy Thomas was on the side of the Angels here, and he was trying to make a statement, you know, that was broadly supportive of inclusivity and equality. Mm-hmm. That being said, I mean, it's really valuable to look at as a historical artifact for what happens when, like, well-meaning but ultimately clueless white people shoot their mouths off about something that they really don't understand.
I thought this was a picture of the limited state of understanding about the Black Power movement on Roy's part. Like, I understand too that people were more fearful of, say, the Black Panthers, the actual party, and Malcolm X, who had been killed, you know, not that long before this, but they weren't wrong. You know, it's mm-hmm. taken a long time for more, especially more white people, to understand that where they're coming from and why people are saying what they're saying. But again, not certain. I don't want to get into woke off either.
It's still not a broadly accepted position, right? You know, I mean, we're still trying to get closer to that, but it is sort of a man. Roy Thomas, he's a young guy. I don't even think he's 30 years old at this point. And he's trying to tell a big story about what's going on in the world. He feels passionately about something. He's also trying to be, like, even-handed about it, you know? But there's, like, this is also kind of the danger of, you know, sometimes there's not really two sides to a story, you know? And it's, like, by trying to say, it's, like, well, see, it's not just, like, you know, the serpents weren't just one dimensional racist white people. There was a Black guy in there too. And
they previously were run by an Asian American I don't even remember, possibly just somebody from China. I can't remember.
They were like a communist plot. Yeah. So
it's kind of a, why can't we all just get along style argument?
Yeah.
Which, like, makes sense if your eyes are mostly closed, but a little bit open, kind of, like, you know, from the right perspective, you're advocating for goodness, but, like, you're ignoring a lot of very important things.
And be careful of, you know, a lot of people who are trying to stoke or play against your hate, bigotry, or racism or prejudices. They're doing that for their own power grab. And that was where all of this stuff was, like, really, I was seriously triggered, like, just going, yeah, this sounds just like what we've just went through as a country last year and the year before that. And, you know, it's just somebody using all of the rhetoric, as people do, in order to gain power, and they don't really care about the outcome.
But I mean, it'd be like, can you imagine that? Like, I guess the equivalent would be, you know, the 2020 election happens and it's like, it's not just that Donald Trump was this horrible person saying all this, but it's like, wait, under that mask, it's Barack Obama too. You know?
That's where it gets so ludicrously.
What are you doing?
But there are a lot of people who still believe that anybody who wants power, or who is in politics, is not well-meaning and they're only egotistically grabbing for power. And a lot of that fits, but it's like, you can't dismiss everybody, and throwing that into the mix just freaking ruined this thing. Wanted some like Klan type people to not like and be the villains. I didn't need this to get layered.
I mean, what's wrong with just punching a Nazi? It was good enough for Captain America.
Yeah.
Like, why can't the Avengers just punch a Nazi? Why can't Black Panther just punch a Nazi?
And it's not like the bad guys, the racists, aren't dressed as monster snakes. You know, like, you said, you pave the road to do what you should have done. And then it's like the last two pages, just shoot it in the knees.
I got to say, between this and between, like, the whole Yellow Jacket story, it's like, boy, Roy, like, you need to bounce your ideas off of a broader circle of people before you commit to them, I think.
Especially these. I mean, it's fine if you want to make a convoluted Hulk story where Doctor Strange shows up whatever. But if you're going to start touching on like very serious topics in a medium that reaches a lot of people, yeah, maybe just test it a bit.
Okay. I don't have a clever transition. Let's start talking about Spider-Man now because
let's get out of this.
That's all I want to say about this. Yeah. Okay. Amazing Spider-Man 83. It's written by Stan Lee, which is a nice, refreshing change of pace. The art's by John Romita, inked by Mickey DeMeo, aka Mike Esposito, under one of his many fake names. Hey, there's a new supervillain for Spidey to tangle with this month. He's called the Schemer, and supervillain, maybe putting it a bit strong, although that's what they call him on the cover. He is basically like a Sopranos style mobster, like a Paulie Walnuts type, but he's in sort of like a half luchador, half matador outfit. The Schemer, living up to his name, he's moving in on the Kingpin's territory after Spidey drove him into hiding in Amazing Spider-Man number 70. If you remember, in that issue, the last time that we saw the Kingpin, he was escaping in a getaway car that was being driven by a woman. And after more than a year, we finally get to meet this woman. It's the Kingpin's wife, Vanessa. We still don't know his name, but we know her name.
I thought his first name was King.
It was King.
His last name is Pin. So it just kind of naturally flowed together.
They shortened it at Ellis Island.
There's a dash, right? Like Nightcrawler.
Kingpin, turns out, has been keeping a secret from her. Their son Richard was reported to have had a fatal accident in the Alps. Kingpin told Vanessa that Richard was just spending some time in Europe after college, which is technically true. You just have to leave out the presumed dead part.
Man, you had a short leash on that lie there, buddy. Like the clock is ticking the second you spill that sentence out.
But anyway, one of the reasons that Kingpin has not been telling her this, though, he's in denial that their son is dead, but Vanessa believes that he died by his own hand after learning what his father really did for a living. So anyway, Spidey, he's out and about, beats up some of the Schemer's goons. Peter Parker takes the pictures and tries to sell them to J. Jonah Jameson, who lowballs him. But he gets a little bit. He gets like $5 a photo for it. But some of his financial anxiety is relieved when Aunt May's doctor reminds him that her medical bills will be covered by Medicaid.
That about?
It was a new thing. I mean, fairly new. I think it took effect in 65. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there must have just been like people writing in saying, why is Peter Parker worried about Aunt May's medical bills? They're covered by Medicaid.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah. So there you go.
You think of Medicaid as just always having been there.
Yeah.
You know, because obviously the nation should take care of the people who are sick within it.
Whoa, 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 Jamie. That sounds insane. That sounds like socialism, dude.
Yeah, sorry. I had a serpent meeting to go to after that. My wires crossed.
Let's see. From there, Peter joins Gwen, MJ, and Harry to see Flash Thompson off to Vietnam. MJ and Gwen plant some serious smooches on Flash. So at least he's got that going for him because, I mean, next year or so is not going to be great for him.
Yeah. Grim. Yeah.
We know Flash's future. And
yeah.
Dang.
Boy. On their way home, Peter and Gwen are nearly run over by an out-of-control delivery truck. It's another one of the Schemer's plots. They're looking to rob that truck. It's like an armored truck, I guess. Peter and Gwen are just collateral damage in the crime wave. They weren't targeted. Peter manages to protect his secret identity and Gwen, which he seems to care about in equal amounts, and then goes into action as Spidey once she's out of danger and she's on her way to the hospital.
But he does have to, hold up a big heavy thing for a minute.
Up a big heavy thing. Not for the last time in this issue. Spidey follows the spider tracer he planted on the Schemer's goon's car. He discovers the Schemer's headquarters, busts in through the window, takes out the mooks. But when he tries to capture the Schemer, who's sitting at his futuristic control center desk, as all villains seem to have in this era.
They get the sweetest desks, man.
It's pretty great. He nearly gets squished when it transforms into a hydraulic press. So there's your second big heavy thing of the issue. After a page or two of doing another riff on the big heavy thing, he destroys the press, which KOs everyone in the room except the schemer, who escapes in the confusion. And with no leads to follow and no more goons to womp on, Peter heads to the hospital to check on Gwen. He gets there just before visiting hours end, but she's upset that he wasn't there sooner. And she's really upset. Captain Stacy kind of leads Peter away and has a heart-to-heart with Peter. And Peter almost slips up and gives away his secret identity. He thinks he covered for it, but, I mean, come on. Captain Stacy is no dummy. Has he already figured out that Peter Parker is Spider-Man? It's a cliffhanger. We'll never know.
I thought he might think that Peter is gay.
He thinks something.
There's a lot. I don't know what he thinks.
He says, I should be used to people never knowing the truth about me.
Yeah.
What's more, you know, Occam's razor, that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. It does seem like it could be a lot of things. Like, I'm on the white horse. I like the heroine.
Think about that.
Whatever would be shameful to hide from society, but probably Captain Stacy's thinking 9 other things before Spider-Man.
You know? Yeah. All right. Jamie, can you give us a quick run through of what Cap was up to this month?
Oh boy. Yeah. I almost forgot about poor little Cap.
More importantly, what MODOK is up to.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. I feel like Gene Colan almost forgot about what Cap was up to this month. He's like, I feel like maybe 5 days before this was due, he's like, oh, damn it.
I said I'd do that. I've got a dry Cap.
Yeah. I'll be back in 10 minutes. All right. So this is Captain America 124, Mission Stop the Cyborg, written by Stan Lee, art by Gene Colan and Joe Sinnott.
I want to say that maybe no one put in a ton of effort on this one. I think this is like, it feels like a deadline crush with a title like that. And frankly, the plot. Yeah.
And the villain. Yeah. I mean, not MODOK, but we'll get there.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So we open on Cap beating up some AIM henchmen who have been sent by MODOK. And while Cap's fighting them, MODOK is converting a man into a remote control cyborg, kind of.
Two guys fight Cap. They come back. Well, he has one killed and lets the other guy volunteer to be part of a terrible, terrible body experiment.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay.
Do you want to die or body horror?
Yeah.
I guess body horror. I don't know. He says at one point, he's like, what is a cyborg again? And like, don't worry about it.
Yeah, nobody knows. It's 1969.
Get in the tube, kid. Yeah.
Yeah, so eventually MODOK succeeds in creating the cyborg, kind of. And we talk a little bit about what the cyborg looks like.
Oh, yeah.
So you might be picturing a Terminator-esque figure with a half man, half machine, kind of robot face, maybe some glowing eyes. Yeah, so this guy's blue. He's shirtless. He has elf ears. He has a metal hat like a Tin Woodsman and purple underwear that goes up to his third half.
No indicator that he is a cyborg at all.
Yeah, this is completely divorced from the cyborg concept as it has grown to become.
It looks like a cyborg from like a 1950s B movie, you know, like a science fiction movie that was shot on a shoestring budget.
But why the ears and stuff? Like,
well, I mean, because it's what they had lying around in the props department. But it's like Gene seems to have forgotten that he's working in comics where like you have an unlimited special effects budget.
You can draw whatever you want. Yeah, right. Like there's not a wire.
Gene just looking around like, I don't know. The cyborg has I see some elf ears over here. So let's just put some elf ears on that guy.
Right.
Or he's a Vulcan. I don't know. Let's just, I got to get this done in 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's not mechanical. Yeah. There's really no, it's very odd.
I'll also say, like, as much as I love Gene Colan's character design was not necessarily his strongest suit. He's come up with some real winners so far.
All right, so anyway, Cap heads to the barbershop, S.H.I.E.L.D. HQ, to demand that Nick Fury take Sharon off of active duty so that he can have a relationship with her without having to worry about her. And he not only says that, but he threatens to not answer S.H.I.E.L.D.'s next call if Fury doesn't give in to his demands.
Seems very out of character for Cap. And Sharon's reaction seems very out of character for Sharon.
Yeah, she's like, oh, that's cool. Yeah.
I'll do a desk job. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't mind being told what to do now and again. So Fury gives in. Sharon more or less rolls with the punches and accepts the desk job. Meanwhile, as a test run, the cyborg successfully robs a bank and returns with the money.
Armfuls of money, yeah.
Armful, like just stacks and stacks of cash. And yeah, in the most poignant part of the whole issue, MODOK says that it's just meaningless and to throw the money away. That's where I thought the issue should have ended.
With the yeah. Little
So then we get these two back-to-back panels. Sharon answers the phone at SHIELD HQ, gets a message that she relays to Cap from Fury about a location that he needs to go to. So she says goodbye, but then like, so she hangs up the phone and then like Fury walks by and he's like, hey, I'm stepping out, going on a quote on a caper. And she's like, well, what just, there's just a call, but she doesn't tell the Fury that was leaving. So there have been two contrasting Nick Fury moments. Like,
right. She's not good at the desk job yet, I guess.
Right. Yeah. She's just started. It's her first day.
She's like, I should have, after he walks out, like, oh, I should have told him that somebody impersonated him and called me. Oh, well, he's gone. So, yeah.
Right. And yeah, I don't know. You would think there'd be a code name or a code word or something when Nick Fury calls to like ensure that it's him and not just like a kid.
You might. Yeah.
Yeah. Doing the best Nick Fury impersonation.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Grumble, grumble, do this. Grumble, grumble, cigar. Grumble,
there's,
grumble.
I mean, yeah, so this whole story, I'm going to just blow the ending right here. like, it's all leading up to Sharon winds up going into action because she thinks Cap's in danger and she tries to save him. And Cap sees that as a huge betrayal. And so, like, all the stuff is leading up to that. That's, like, the crux of the story, you know, the big climax. And none of it makes any sense. Like it's really sloppily kind of shoehorned in there to like get us to that point. But you have Cap and Sharon behaving really out of character, not even just like being out of character, but just like doing dumb things. Like they're incompetent.
Right.
Which is also, I guess, out of character for both.
Which I thought maybe this was a setup for something else. Like these are malfunctioning LMDs.
Yeah,
or I don't know.
Yeah.
Right.
Like
right,
it seemed so dumb that I kept waiting for some other shoe to land that they were not the characters we expected, especially Sharon when she's just like, well, I technically said I wouldn't quit working for SHIELD. And since you're just going to make them take me off of cases, but work at a desk, I'm cool.
Yeah, and she gives him a hug and like the angle up from her, she's like in his shoulder kind of, mm-hmm. and like looking towards the camera or the audience or whatever. And she looks almost sinister. There's a panel where it looks like she's maybe evil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is not nonsense. It's just, I can't make it work.
So, I mean, the whole thing is being set up to have Cap have a more or less clean break from SHIELD and Sharon because Captain America is about to hit the road on his super sweet motorcycle.
But we didn't need to bring that back we didn't need to dust that off. Like it already seemed like they were separated and that was how it was going to be.
Yeah. I guess Stan felt they needed to put an exclamation point on it. I don't know, but it was, yeah.
Is there a way to read this even back then that Cap is a good guy in this issue? Or if you bought this as a child, would you be like, why is he
not even compared to other issues? He's a dick. Yeah. He's not been this dickish. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like you would have called your friends or bicycled to your friend's house. I assume they didn't have phones back then. And like, and been like, what was up
they
with
did,
that
but
issue?
They were gross and you had to put money in them.
Yeah. right.
Yeah.
So, speaking of sad sack heroes, let's talk about the Surfer. How's that, you guys?
That's very good. Very good.
Silver Surfer number 14, called The Surfer and the Spider, by Stan Lee, John Buscema, with Dan Adkins. So we get promised on the cover, we're going to get a team up here. We see Spidey and Surfer. So
I had to talk to my family about this cover alone. It says sooner or later, it had to happen. The Surfer battles Spider-Man.
What?
No,
it had to?
It didn't. No, not even close. Universe did it have to happen.
Yeah. No, it's a space guy. He's in space doing space stuff or like overseas doing political commentary.
And I love how they finally meet. But so we'll get there in just a second. But the issue starts with Surfer discovering two meteors plummeting towards Earth, and they're about to collide right above Earth. So whether or not they hit Earth, they're about to make some kind of insane detonation. And I guess we were definitely not watching the skies very well in 1970. Surfer gets between the two of them, destroys them with the old cosmic power, and is knocked out by his own blast and their explosion, and falls past some guys in space who are like, we can't call this in because they'll think we're crazy. And falls to the bottom of the Hudson or the East River or a river. It's definitely a river. And it's definitely in the New York area. We get a interlude where a kid named Henry is watching a Captain America TV show. And his dad flips out about Henry's Marvel comics being useless daydreams.
Henry's dad is the worst villain in this entire month of comics.
Yeah, agreed.
And I'm including the fake white supremacist.
Henry then sees the recovering surfer fly by they're probably up many stories. Fly by on his board and calls out to his dad, but it's too late for him to see anything cool. Now we cut to Spidey swinging home, and then he almost misses a ledge and ends up attaching his web to Surfer's board by accident. So this is a natural meeting of these two characters.
It's actually terrific. Like I really love that. Like it was a funny moment. And then of course, because both of them are the most thin-skinned characters in the Marvel universe, of course they're going to have a hilarious misunderstanding.
Right. Yep. So Surfer assumes he's being tricked because Spidey's like, hey, can you just take me down? I screwed up and, you know, webbed your board. And he's like, no, everybody tricks me. Everybody tricks me. You're tricking me. And so he finally gets it. So Spidey gets feisty because Surfer is taking him up too high, and he will fall to his death if he goes up too high. So they get in the fight for a page or so. Spidey ends up nearly falling to his death because his web gets melted by cosmic power. But Surfer shoots past him, breaks a fire hydrant. So the geyser of water halts Spidey's fall at the last minute. That's called science. That's actually the best science of all the other times I've called science.
Yeah.
Then we cut back to good old Henry the kid, who sees Surfer fly by again, and he's like, not letting this go by. So he runs up to the top of his building's roof to get a better view. And this is where Spidey catches back up to Surfer, who's just sort of sitting there because he's still a little dazed from the whole meteor thing in the first place. So they restart their fight for many pages this time. I thought we were just like, okay, cool. They fought. Now they're going to do some team up stuff or whatever. Nope. We're back to it. The fight is so big that the authorities get worried, and they send in not only cops, but the army, like tanks rolling down the street, helicopters, whatever, like Hulk levels in the city. So Henry's dad, who is of course the villain of the month, can't find Henry and is worried. So that's a little nice, but he shouldn't have been such a jerk about the comics.
Yeah.
Since there's all this superhero nonsense going on. So Henry is up on the roof farting around on Surfer's board. Surfer doesn't have his board with him. He's just sort of punching with Spider-Man and melting fire escapes and all kinds of cool stuff. And so Henry's just like, that would be pretty sweet if you're just getting to play around on the board. Then Surfer, who apparently is shaking off his days, just beams a car in and wraps it around Spidey. he just like sort of levitates it over. So Magneto style. Mm-hmm. That's when the army sees that Surfer's, and I guess that they've decided Surfer is the worst concern. Mm-hmm. Spidey sucks, but well, Surfer.
He did bring the guy to Earth who tried to eat the planet.
True. Oh, yeah, that's true. That's his bad. That's his bad.
Battle chestnut. Ugh, get over it already.
Yeah, just one time. So the army starts just shooting a bunch of stuff at Surfer. And then Surfer's like, okay, I'm out. So he calls the board. But guess what? Henry, previously farting around on the board, is still on it. And he is being drawn into the massive amount of shooting and exploding stuff. he was, you know, thought he was having a good time, and now he's headed into a Michael Bay movie. So Surfer takes a bunch more hits so he can protect the kid and get him to the ground. So he's just like, okay, I have to focus while they're shooting me to keep this kid safe and get him down. Spidey and the army then figure out that the Surfer, he means well after all. Since they don't kick him while he's down, Surfer wraps this up by thinking maybe there is hope for the stupid humans after all. He doesn't call them stupid. I do. But that's
routinely. Yeah. Outside of this podcast.
Yeah. Stupid humans. I don't associate myself as one of them humans. Yeah.
Well, here's two humans who are not stupid wrote letters into this month's Silver Surfer. Which this is one of the few issues where the letters page is also on Marvel Unlimited. But one of them was Alan Brennert, who is the writer of a number of comics for DC mostly, including Wonder Woman, Detective Comics, Brave and the Bold. And he also wrote Batman Holy Terror, which was the first DC Elseworlds comic.
Sweet.
I think he also had that behind me. Yeah, he also wrote the issue of Daredevil that followed Frank Miller's run. So no pressure.
Yeah, that poor bastard. Oh, man. Yeah.
And then also we got a letter from Doug Mensch, a longtime Batman comics writer, but more relevant for our purposes as the man who created Moon Knight and Deathlok for Marvel. He also wrote like 80 issues or so of Master of Kung Fu and a bunch of issues of Werewolf by Night. So we're about to start coming up on a bunch of his stuff. All right, fellas. Well, if we had a buck to spend on comics in January 1970 and we'd already bought the issues that we talked about with Joe Keating last week, well, we'd be 20 cents in the hole. So that's not going to work. So let's just say that we can each purchase one of these issues for this month. So just one. Rob, what's it going to be?
Oh, man. I think it's going to be Iron Man. I don't enjoy Johnny Craig's work as much as you do, but mm-hmm. I still think there were so many cool nuggets of storytelling in there that, that it's worth it. And it's just like the best told book this month. Everything else, if you try to judge on least convoluted, then Iron Man stands out. It's shining beacon of golden red.
There you go. Jamie, I know you're not going to pick Daredevil because for whatever reason you just abandoned us while we were talking about that one.
I hate devils and I hate dares.
So I don't know. I'm just going to guess Avengers 74.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love snakes and I like men dressed like snakes. I'm going to go with Incredible Hulk. I like the the connective tissue DNA of that. You know, draft one of a favorite Nightcrawler character. Mm-hmm. Sort of a rough sketch that they then refined. They kept the blue, you know.
Yep.
Some of the art was literally really cool.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, they threw literally everything else out, but the blue still stuck.
The biggest crossover event so far in Marvel history. Yeah.
How about you?
I'm also going to go with Iron Man. I thought for a brief moment about going with the Silver Surfer just because I think, I thought John Buscema's art on that one, I thought he put a little bit more into it than we have seen him do on Surfer recently. And I'm sure a lot of that is due to deadlines or whatever. But it's also the first time we've seen the Surfer like connected to the Marvel Universe in a meaningful way. I mean, it's not like he had a supporting cast for this issue, but he kind of did.
Yeah. You know? I loved that Henry was part like that almost made me pick it too. Just the kid and the whole, like the meta version of the kid watching a Captain America show and having his dad like hold up the comic books and tell him what crap they are. Yeah. That was nice.
I feel like if they had handed up a little bit more and like you put like Flight of the Bumblebee kind of as a soundtrack underneath it, and it, like I feel like it could have had more strong humor potential.
Yeah,
it just kind of skirts away from that.
Yeah, I think. Like I said, I don't think it was Iron Man. I just loved so much just for the Johnny Craigness of it, and the story, like so much story in there. It just like that one worked for me on every level, but no, I think Silver Surfer, this is the first issue of Silver Surfer in a while that I really enjoyed. So yeah, so there you go. Also, reviews. We are still collecting them. They still help new listeners discover the show, and they will also still get you some goodies in the mail if you send a screenshot of your 5-star review to marvelbythemonth@gmail.com with your mailing address. Here's one that was left on Apple Podcasts on the 1st of October by El Jefe Primate, which is a good handle.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's headlined, "How Comics Got Their Groove Back." I've been a comic retailer for 28 years, so reading and hearing about comics is a bit of a busman's holiday, and I rarely read them much anymore. MBTM has rekindled the fun that got me started reading comics as a kid. For that alone, I thank them, but they get my undying gratitude for finally saying what we've all been thinking about a self-aggrandizing S.H.I.E.L.D. artist and for suffering the sins of Hank Pym so that we don't have to. Thank you so much, El Jefe. I am sorry that I haven't mailed your stuff yet. Hopefully by the time you hear this, it will have shown up. So there we go.
Nice. I've read that review so many times.
It's good.
Basically every day since it's come out.
It's your daily affirmation. Well, that's all for this week. You can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/MarvelByTheMonth. Instagram's our main social channel, so you can find us there at Marvel by the Month, and MarvelByTheMonth.com has links to our other social channels as well as our shop. Thank you very much for listening. For Marvel by the Month, I'm Brian Stratton.
I'm Rob Milne.
And I'm Jamie Wenger.
And we'll see you next week for next month.